So I'm talking to Commodore Peter Levy, who was the commander of the Joint Task Force involved in the search for Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. Commodore Levy, how did this mission come together? How did the task force stand up?
The ADF put together a task force a couple of weeks after the aircraft itself went missing. It first went missing, as you know, on the 8th of March. Initially, as with any search and rescue activity, it was headed up by AMPSA, the Australian Maritime Safety Authority, from the Australian perspective, working with the Malaysian authorities. There was a little delay, I guess, before the ADF got involved. As you'd understand, the initial search area was between Kuala Lumpur and Beijing, so it took some time and some really good work from the technical analysts to work out that the aircraft was perhaps down in the Indian Ocean, and that's when we got heavily involved. Personally, I had about 48 hours notice to move across to Perth with a small team, and we established ourselves at HMAS Stirling over there. But we were fitting in our command structure to a wider search and rescue effort that was already in place. And it's probably worth noting too that the Australian Defence Force was a supporting agency to AMPSA in the initial part of the search. We weren't leading it ourselves, we were providing the assets. But a lot of the legwork on focusing the search areas was actually done by AMPSA. That's where their expertise is, and that's their remit.
So you're the commander, you're plugging into a wider civilian maritime search agency effort. What was the scale of the mission from your perspective?
It was quite large. We had up to about 18 aircraft from seven different nations, and at various times up to about 15 to 16 ships, a mixture of civilian ships and naval ships from five different nations, plus a submarine, of course. So the scale there was quite significant. Diverse nations from China, obviously a very heavy interest with the number of passengers they had on board MH370. Malaysia heavily involved as well, and obviously Australia being in our search and rescue zone, we were quite heavily involved. But the coordination challenges there were, were tempered by it not being a combat operation, so that made it relatively, took out one degree of complexity. But just the different language barriers were a bit of a challenge. But we worked through that fairly quickly. One good thing about navies in particular is what we had as a navy, and I had personally exercised with every nation that was participating there. So we do tend to understand how each other work, how we operate, and the various strengths that each of those teams brought to the search area. So the coordination, in a sense, was a bit of work behind the scenes, but relatively straightforward. And made all the much easier by everyone having that single focus on the mission, which for us was actually finding debris floating on the surface initially. We had, as you know, Ocean Shield doing the partway through, started the underwater search, but that was really only one asset. The focus for us, particularly early on, but the focus throughout for the majority of our assets was really on that surface search for debris that was floating, which would help the drift modelling backcast to try and pinpoint the crash site.
And you obviously had a fair bit of tactical interaction between the different search aircraft and ships over in WA as well.
We did the air task group, so all the aircraft that were involved in the search were based in RAF Pierce, and a couple were down at Perth Airport. They would get the search areas, and they had a very robust organisation behind them actually at Pierce, allocating search areas to aircraft on a day-by-day basis, a fairly resource-intensive task. But the advantage there is all the aircrew are co-located, they can all brief, and they were doing that daily, and they all had a very good appreciation of what each other was doing. So that was very very well coordinated, and Group Captain Heap from the Royal Australian Air Force led that effort over there, did a fantastic job. On the maritime side, the coordination at sea, we did exchange liaison officers, particularly with the Chinese. So we had one of the XOs off one of the Chinese ships joined HMAS Success, which was our on-scene command ship at sea. So the tactical level interaction and the ability to translate and the like was very well handled, both at the maritime and at the air, in the air spheres on the scene. Again, a great testament to militaries, navies and air forces working together a lot. In many cases, people had actually known each other from the other nations, which again facilitated that ease of transfer of information. So all in all, I think it was a really good, a very good exercise in coordinating assets at very short notice. Obviously, our major exercises we do, there's a lot of lead up and planning. We want to get the most out of them from a military context, but in situations like this, things happen at very short notice, and the ability to understand how each other operate, it was so beneficial when we came together. It was a very quick planning process. Everyone was on the same wavelength, Everyone understood the mission, and that made that commander's intent, if you like, very easy to disseminate, and allowed the tactical commanders on the scene to get on and do the job.
I think one of the extraordinary things to come out of this as an observer is that people have realised that not every part of the ocean is surveilled on a constant basis. Not every satellite can see what's happening, that sometimes it's just about how far can you get your aircraft and how long can you keep them on station. Australia's got an enormous maritime search and rescue zone. What lessons have you learnt from running this task force that you think will be of enduring relevance to Australian civilian maritime agencies or to the Royal Australian Navy?
Oh, look, it's probably the lessons that we always know. Communications is the big one. Establish that communications and the coordination mechanisms very early. I think we're reasonably well practiced in doing that. This is probably the most challenging search and rescue situation that I've certainly been involved in. It's probably the first time where we seem to have an aircraft that has disappeared with no mayday calls, no electronic distress signals, no debris being found. I think that's quite unprecedented. So this was extremely challenging. But I think the key lessons out of this really is that ongoing relationships that you have with sister navies, air forces, and the ability to, or the value in working together in an exercise environment that just brings or provides militaries with the wherewithal to come together at short notice for a specific task and form up in a very coordinated fashion very quickly. So probably no new lessons there. We're really relearning old lessons. And I'm pleased to say there was no real showstoppers in this situation. There's obviously a lot of low-level details that had to get sorted through and a lot of work to keep a lot of those mechanisms in place. But everyone was on board with trying to constantly strive for that end state we were seeking. And that, coupled with the fact that we have worked together with each other, even if not as individuals, certainly as navies, we do understand each other reasonably well, and that allows that coordination to happen relatively seamlessly.
So you ran this mission for 6 weeks. The result, inconclusive to an extent, we're now in, I guess, what you'd call an operational pause, where a lot of the data's being revalidated, re-examined, reviewed. Where do you see the search for MH370 heading to next?
Look, that's really up to the Australian Transport Safety Bureau, who have the lead now. The Australian Defence Force commitment has effectively completed just this last weekend with the final return of Defence Vessel Ocean Shield back alongside and demounting the Bluefin 21 autonomous underwater vehicle that many people have heard of and the towed ping locator equipment that was given to us by or loaned to us by the US Navy through Phoenix International. That equipment is now returning to the United States, and Ocean Shield is no longer directly involved in the search. So the ATSB, as I understand it, are now looking at various commercial options for wider area surveillance of side scan sonars to continue with their subsurface search along the arc, the well known now, I think, Inmarsat arc, where we think is the most likely final resting place of the aircraft. But that's a wide area of water to search. Underwater searching obviously is much, much slower than the surface search for debris, which can be done largely by aircraft. So I think we're in potentially for quite a long time here, and I think Air Chief Marshal Houston, the head of the Joint Agency Coordination Centre, has made this point time and time again, that underwater searches like this, the phase that we're transitioned to now, are generally very slow, very deliberate. But they do take time, and it's going to be, I think, many, many months potentially before we see any developments. We obviously hope that we'll get some sooner rather than later, but it's really out of our hands now. But in terms of the Defence Force participation, the form of participation, that's really scaled right back now. It's become a civil agency-led search and recovery operation.
Commodore Levy, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, James.